On February 9th of 2004, 21-year-old UMass student Maura Murray drove from her dorm in Amherst, Massachusetts to the White Mountains of New Hampshire.
At approximately 7:27 p.m., Maura spun out her 1996 Saturn on a hairpin turn on Route 112 in North Haverhill. There has never been a credible sighting of Maura since.
Maura is 5'7" tall. She weighs 120 pounds, and she has brown hair and hazel eyes.
If you have any information regarding Maura's disappearance, please submit it to us, the Murray family, through their Facebook page, or the New Hampshire State Police Cold Case Unit.
This is Missing Maura Murray. Welcome back to the Missing Maura Murray podcast. I'm Tim, here today with Lance in the Crawlspace Studios in Wormtown. Lance, how are you?
I'm doing very well, thank you. How are you?
I'm doing well, and we are also being joined by two very special guests. One is more familiar to the audience. That's Chloe Cantor from the Crawlspace podcast. What's up, Chloe?
Not much. Happy to be here. Thank you.
Well, we are excited to have you here.
And our guest, who is not as familiar to the audience, is Karen Mayotte.
Very happy to be here as well. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for joining us. I said before we started recording that I was nervous about this. I don't know if I've been as anxious for an interview. This is sort of a humbling experience right now.
So. Oh, well, that's a compliment. Well, thank you, though. No, it is a pleasure to be here. So thank you for having me.
Yeah, thank you for reaching out. We really appreciate it. And obviously, you are a person involved in this story, have been talked about over the years.
Yes.
By us and by people on message boards and things like that. So it is great that you reached out and we can actually hear directly from you what your experience with Maura was.
Quick bit of background. Karen is the person who saw Maura the night that she had the phone call where it shook her and she said the words, "My sister." She was at her job and you were the supervisor at the time.
Yes, that is correct.
Right. So this has been out there, like you said, in blogs and on message boards, and people have speculated as to what the conversation was, and people have even gone so far as to speculate what Maura's state of mind was, which is cool that you're here with Chloe because we can start to get into the psychological aspect of this. And including myself saying things that I had just learned through what I've read. And that was one of the reasons why you reached out, because you heard this. I have very little memory of what I said, but it was something to the effect of you might have had an agenda of your own.
Yes, that is correct. Yep.
And I apologize for that.
No, it really is wonderful to be here, though, because after all the years, it's still a very big part of myself, what had happened. So, yeah.
And when you wrote that to me on Facebook that Lance said something like that, I had no defense of Lance because I didn't even understand what it meant. So I was like, I'm sorry, I don't even know what he's talking about.
I mean, I vaguely remember somebody saying that. I can't remember where I read it, but I remember reading somebody making conclusions about why you said certain things, and they in their writing they said, "This is someone who acts like they would have an agenda of their own."
Mm-hmm.
And
yes, yep.
I remember just looking at it in such a vacuum of that moment and saying, oh, that does make sense. But that's the danger of this.
And that's why it's
journey.
Wonderful to be here. Exactly.
Okay, good.
Exactly.
Good.
So I totally agree.
There's so much speculation out there. I believe that comment, because I'm familiar with the message board comment you're thinking of. And it started with, you know, Karen was the only person that witnessed this event. No one can really corroborate it or confirm it. And I think it just escalated from there and it's entirely baseless.
And that's what, yeah, exactly. That's how, because I teach my students a lot about social media and all that stuff. So that's what, exactly. So it's totally understandable. So it's good to be here.
Good. Good.
Okay. So let's move on from that. I also just wanted to mention that Chloe, your official title at your job is psychiatric counselor, right?
Yes.
Out of all the times we've had you on this show or Crawl Space, this is like the most appropriate time to ever have you on the podcast, I think.
Sure. Yeah. I believe that night has been a source of great speculation from the entire community because it was an emotional event. Speculation is, could this have caused the disappearance? Could this have caused her to leave? And it's something that I've explored myself. So I think getting deeper into it, hearing about it from the source can kind of help us unpack it a little.
Yes. Yeah, definitely.
And it's really refreshing to hear things from the people that were what I've been starting to call is like the close circle, like back in the day, back in 2003, 2004, yeah. 2005, there's this group of people. You are one of those people, the important people who knew Maura, who talked with her, experienced her, and maybe even have information leading to us to figure out what was going on in her head the days before she decided to take this trip.
Exactly. Yeah.
So it's very important. So
I agree.
Okay.
Yeah. So let's get to this night.
So yeah. So I guess take us through what happened.
So for a bit of background knowledge, because I was at UMass Amherst and I worked security. So for security, there's different positions. So I was the supervisor. So basically at every one of the dorms, they would have the receptionist in the dorms. And if you went to colleges, you know what that looks like when you walk into a building. You have to show your IDs, or there's different fancy systems nowadays to get admitted into a building. So I was in charge of those employees. So basically every night when the shift was on, we would go to all the buildings. We would give them breaks. And their term was the security receptionists. So the receptionists were the ones who worked in the dorm buildings, like right in the lobby themselves. So as a supervisor, I was, I'm a very social, fun person. So my job, it was really nice because I got to hang out with a lot of people each night from all around campus. So my job was to give breaks. And if there's any problems at dorms, like with people getting in that shouldn't be in the dorm or whatnot, so like with a lot of different responsibilities, because college campuses can be a bit crazy themselves. No, but so she was a receptionist. I'm not exactly sure when she was hired as a receptionist, but I worked with her we were good friends for like 6+ months from the job itself. Probably before then, I just figured exactly when she was hired. And so she worked in Southwest. If you're familiar with UMass, that's like the busy, like almost like urban like style part of the campus with the tall, like they have like the skyscraper buildings, like the 20, whatever, how many floors, like 22 floors. And so on this Thursday night in question, when she received the phone call, I was a floater, meaning I went through all of the parts of campus. And on those nights, you always want to end up in Southwest because that's like the busiest, the most student population in that area. So you want to get to there at the end of the night because that's where they usually have the most problems with security and whatnot. So I started at like Northeast on campus, Sylvan. I'm sure a lot of listeners might know the UMass area by now from like just researching and whatnot. And I think it was about, after so many years, I don't know the exact times, but it was around 10:30 when I would have ended up in Southwest for my night shift. We started at like 6 o'clock. We'd got briefings by like 6:45 or 7. We're like out in the field walking around. So by 10:30, I got to Southwest. And there's this, I forget the name of the eatery. There was a place on campus would always, that would be like our like late snack time. So we went to go get some food with the other, and we would always meet up with the other supervisors who were in Southwest the whole night. So we had like two supervisors who'd always be in Southwest the whole night while myself, I was just going in between the areas. So we'd have extra supervisors at the end of the night from the two extras who were like floating around. So we'd always like meet up to get some pizza or whatnot whenever we got to that area that night. We just like let them know. There was two guys I was working with. I forget the name, but he told me, he said, you better go check on Mara. She's not doing so well. And at that point, I got extremely worried about her because to hear that about anyone, it gets you nervous. So I didn't even sit down to eat. So at that point, I went right over to Melville where she was working, which was like a 3-minute walk away from where we were getting the food. And we had our ID cards because we could swipe into any building we would want that we needed to go check on the receptionists. Otherwise, if you were on campus only, if you were a student of Melville, only like your ID would get into that building. So long story short, so I get to Melville and I swipe in and I walk in, and like I'm always a very happy cherry person, so I had a huge smile on my face to go check, you know, see what's going on, to go visit her with her like many other nights. But walking in, she wouldn't even like make eye contact with me. Like she was, when you walk in, her the security, the desk, the receptionist desk area was like directly in front of you walking into Melville. And she was like, she was just like looking like past me. It was very weird. Because normally I wouldn't get that reaction from her, like going to visit, you know, visit with her. I'd usually just smile and say, hi, walking in. But so I walk up. So she was like just staring out into space, like staring out the window. The window, there was like large windows right next to the door. And so at that point, I was totally concerned just from that primary reaction from her. So then I walked right up to, there was like this little like enclavery, like next to the desk, a little ear that could stand, there's room for me to stand next to. So I remember walking right beside her. I have some very strong memories of like this situation, even after what, 14 years? My goodness. Yeah. After 14 years. And I wasn't sure how to, what to say next to her, like start a conversation. Cause I'm not an expert in like the psychology of like, it's, I knew she was extremely upset. I knew something was going on. So I asked her, I say, what's going on? What can I do for you? I know time can get kind of strange when something like this happens. Like if you're experiencing something like, all I know, like years ago, I was in an armed robbery. Like it was a pretty violent thing. And I just remember like it was a 20-minute robbery. I only remember like 1 minute of it, like that type of stuff. Like it's great. Like it's all I can only like, so nothing like that. This was nothing violent. But when I was talking with her, I don't remember how long it took her for her to finally respond to me. I don't know if I was standing there for like 1 minute or like five. I don't know how much quiet time was between us. But eventually she said, my sister, because I don't know, like if I kept asking her like over and over, like what's going on. But it was definitely some awkward like time in between where she was just staring out the window, wouldn't even like engage with me. There's probably a fancy term with psychology. I don't know, but she wouldn't engage with me. But eventually she just said, my sister. And then she started crying, but it wasn't like a huge sob, but she was just like, she was, I would say like crying softly, crying softly, whatnot. And at that point, I just remember putting my arm around her and just saying, what can I do for you? I don't know. I don't remember these exact words I said at this moment. I just remember with my sister. At one point, it was just awkward time, so I couldn't really, because she wouldn't tell me anything else except those words. I think she said my sister like twice, like that statement. And at that point, I was trying to figure out what to do. And oh yes, at that point, there was Mel. I forget if it was an all girl though, but I knew because there was two people. There was a lady who swiped into the building to come inside. And I knew from the other guy with her that he was not a student because I could see his ID and it had a different color on the bottom, whatever. So they should have signed him in, but they just like walked right past Mara. And I'm just kind of thinking like, this is not good, you know, because her job was to be signing them in. Otherwise, you know, you're not doing your job as receptionist. So at that point, I kind of realized that she shouldn't be even working. Not for her. Not that I was upset with her, but I felt bad that she wasn't able to, you know, do her job that night. And the second thing was, I remember that the last few months at work, we were having issues with people on cell phones, like being being distracted by their cell phone. So they weren't supposed to have like cell phones on their desk either. They're supposed to be like hidden away. You know, they sometimes they'd get away with it, or they would try to be sneaky and like put a cell phone like under a notebook or something to try to hide it from us. But hers was like in blatant view, like in front of me. I'm like, oh, that's not good either. But of course, that was my least of my concerns with her. So at that point, I remember going out of the building just for a minute because I didn't want to talk to my supervisor in front of her because I thought that'd be awkward. So I went out of the building. I remember I called Nate. So when we were doing security in the dispatch office, back then it was right above the police department. Now I heard that the police department's moved a different part of campus. So I called my dispatcher. They work in the office with our walkie-talkies. They're in charge of all of us. And I remember just telling Nate, I said, she's not doing so well. Can I please just let her go home and get off shift? And he said, of course you can. So, because I told him that that she let like two people go, like a guy go in without even checking his ID. So he gave me permission to do so. So I remember going back in the building, like I was just right outside. I could still see her when I was talking to him on my cell phone. And I went back in the building and I told her, I'm going to pack you up so you can, you know, you can be done. And before I packed her up, I asked her, I said, oh, tonight we always, on Thursday nights, we always go to Dunkin' Donuts right in Hadley, right down the road, because they were the only like eatery like open late after our shifts, whatever. And I told her, you should come with us so we can just talk and like, you know, just hang out and so I can just I forget what I said. So I can make you feel better, whatever. I forget the exact term I said at that point. And at that point, at this point, because before she just said to me, my sister, like that was it for like communication verbal wise. And at this point she said, no, I have a big test tomorrow. And I remember her looking at this huge, it was like a, I don't know how many pages, but a huge like nursing book right on her desk next to her, like open. It was opened. She was studying it. I don't know if she was studying, but it was open to like one third of the way through the book or whatever. And so she said, nope, I can't tonight. So I remember writing down my cell phone with my name, and I put my cell phone on a little scrap of paper right next to him. Like, please, you know, call me like call me when I get out. Well, the thing is, we couldn't, like, I couldn't leave my shift because I knew she was going to get off duty right at that moment. But I had to work another like 2.5 hours. So I couldn't go to Dunkin's with her just then. But I said, I'll be done at like 2 o'clock. Please call me around then. If you want, still want me to pick you up, we'll go get some coffee together. And she didn't respond to that, but I assumed it was a no because she wouldn't respond to that. So, and I remember, like, I told her again, I'm like, okay, you know, we can unpack up now so you can, you know, get off your shift. And she wasn't even moving. Like, she wasn't doing anything. She was still, like, staring out, like, when I said when I walked in the building, her, like, staring, like, out the door at me. She was just, like, staring, like, straight ahead. Wouldn't even do any, like, she wouldn't even, I had to get her backpack off the floor. I put all of her books in her backpack with her pens and everything else. And I put my cell phone number like on the top of her backpack when I zippered it up. So when they would go on duty, they had to like unlock this box. In the box, there was this phone you'd have to hook up so they could call, you know, like the security office if they needed us, because they weren't supposed to have cell phones if they needed that. And they would take out this binder where they would sign in names of people. Nowadays, I think it's different electronic-wise, but back then you'd have to just write in the names, whatever. And she wouldn't even like physically like put that away. And that was like, you got to put that away before you leave duty. So I remember I had to physically clean off like her whole desk for her, which was kind of odd because she was sitting. I just remember like walking around or getting stuff. I just felt it was. I knew something was up because that was not healthy, happy behavior.
When we spoke to you on the phone, you called Maura in sort of in a catatonic state.
Yeah, because I never knew that. I would say that's because she was just staring away, and she for many, like, I don't know how many exact minutes I was with her at that time in between all this, but it was just an awkward time with, I felt very nervous.
Is that state something you've witnessed before or after?
Never. Not with anyone, actually, that I've ever had interactions with, ever.
I just want to back up really quick to when you entered the hall and you saw Maura. Did you enter through where the students would enter?
Yes. Okay. Yep, the main entrance, yes.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. No, good question, yeah.
And you saw her right away the way a student would see her?
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
Yes, that is correct.
And she was visibly upset at that instantly when you walked in?
Yes, yep.
Okay. And you're not saying that she was using her cell phone. You said the cell phone
exactly.
There.
It was just out. So when I was with her the whole time, I did not see her using it at all. Gotcha. And I didn't see anything pop up for like phone numbers or texts or whatever or any of that stuff. So.
Oh, that's good.
So I did not.
Okay.
Okay. So all she said to you was my sister probably twice.
And I remember trying to pry something out of her about the sister. Like, yeah. I don't exactly. I think like, oh, what's going on with you? But she never responded back whatever I asked her. I didn't get any response back in regard to what was up with her sister.
Gotcha.
So this was Thursday night?
Yes.
She said she had a big test on Friday?
Yes.
Where did you guys go from there? You're gathering her stuff up?
And I physically picked up her backpack for her because she still wasn't moving from her seat. And I started walking away with her backpack. She had her cell phone in her hand. I don't remember the cell phone. I remember, I think she had it like in her hands or her pocket. So I physically started walking away from the desk and she followed me. And then, so we left the building. It was like a 10-foot walk. We left the building. I asked her where she lived, and she didn't answer me, but she just started walking towards Kennedy because you have Melville. You have, like, we call it the Poets' Corner, like Emerson, Melville. What is it? Emerson, James, Melville, Thoreau. So she started walking towards Kennedy, the first tower right next to those buildings. And so I just followed her. It was a very awkward interaction with, because, well, I'm a social person, like I said, and she went, and we talked for many, many nights before that, and she just wouldn't even, like, engage with me, like, walking back to her dorm, and I remember putting my arm around her, and when she got to her dorm, she had her ID out, so she could have physically swiped in to get into Kennedy to go up to her stairs, and she wouldn't even, like, swipe her ID, so I remember I physically had to, like, go in front of her. It was just awkward, I physically swiped the ID, I opened the door for her, I let her go in. And then even when we went past the receptionist of Kennedy working at the time, who knew Maura because they all worked together, those receptionists, Maura didn't say anything to that girl. I forget who it was, but I said quickly, I'm just going to bring her back to her room. And same thing, like Maura, you're supposed to, when in Kennedy, you have keys. So if you go past the receptionist, this was back then, of course, you would have to use your room key to get into the double doors that go to the elevators. And so she was just kind of waiting in front of the doors, getting into the elevators. So I physically went by her and I opened the doors with my key to let her in there. And then at that point, I said, I feel bad. I'm nervous about leaving you alone. And she said, oh, I have a roommate. It's okay. So at that point, I'm still on shift and we're not supposed to go anywhere above the first floor for our role because we don't go in dorm areas, just lobbies. So at that point, I felt awful leaving her there, but I had no other I mean, I don't know. At that point, I didn't think I had another option. And I just remember she went up the stairs. So I assumed she lived on the second, third, or fourth floor or something because she didn't take the elevator. I gave her a kiss on the cheek right before she left. And I said, you know, please call me later tomorrow if you want to get together. She didn't respond back, didn't look back, and went up the stairs. And then at that point, I just went back on duty, like back to what I was doing for my shift. And I called my supervisor right after I dropped her off to say, I remember telling him, I said, I'm still very nervous. I told him, I said, I'm very nervous leaving her like that. I'm very worried about her. But then I forget his response. He cared about it. I forget his response. But then I just had to go back to finish off my shift.
Was there any thought in your head that this could have been something that was maybe alcohol or drug induced?
No, but I was a very naive kid that back then. So I never did it. So you know what? I never would have thought about that. It's a great question, but it didn't occur to me.
Chloe, is this something that you've heard of before, seen yourself perhaps?
Yes, but it's normally in people that are psychotic, when they're not responding and require a lot of prompts to just do basic functional activities. You said she wasn't packing her backpack.
Nope, I had to be up.
She wasn't swiping her card. She was just standing there and she needed prompts to even open the door to walk up the steps.
Yep.
That's
worrisome.
It's very worrisome. Very worrisome. And you bring up catatonia. That's very rare. And normally it's only seen with people that have schizophrenia. It can be seen in other disorders like bipolar, post-traumatic stress. I don't think she has any known psychiatric history, at least that we're aware of.
And I,
at least coming from the family, there wasn't. So catatonia is pretty rare, and usually you can't respond to anything. Like, you're basically unresponsive. Sometimes people that are in that state, if let's say I'm catatonic and you're trying to talk to me, and let's say you go like this to try to touch my shoulder, I'll do the same. Like, I'll literally just mimic your movements.
Yeah.
So I've seen people that are catatonic, and they she wouldn't be able to walk up the stairs. She wouldn't have been able to I can't. Like, I have a test tomorrow. So she seemed to have been in a state that was kind of similar to it, but she was able to function a little bit, and that just makes me think that she was really preoccupied.
Okay, so catatonia is an actual term, a clinical term?
Right, it's a clinical term, and I think it is used more casually. Like, someone that is a psychiatric professional probably wouldn't have said that was catatonia.
Right, and I just want to be clear, you said that I haven't, you know, I've only seen that in people that are psychotic. You work in a psych ward.
Yes.
So I just want to be clear.
Yes. I work in a psychiatric unit, inpatient, acute care for adolescents, adults, and older adults. So I have seen that response, and they can sort of respond, but a lot of it's mirroring your own movements. They're basically the ones that just lie in bed and won't respond to you at all.
Okay.
So with psychosis, there's positive symptoms and negative symptoms. Catatonia is a negative symptom because you can't function.
Okay.
Yep.
So separate from actual classified catatonia, have you seen that kind of behavior, the behavior that Maura was showing?
Yes, I have seen it in some of the patients that I work with every day at my job. I would say that her reaction and associated behaviors most closely align with a dissociative episode. Those can be triggered by a lot of things. Some people even have a disorder where they chronically are in dissociative episodes, which basically is a disruption in your consciousness, in your identity, in your memory. You feel disconnected from your emotions, from your surroundings, and that can make you a little bit less responsive. Those can be triggered by severe anxiety, severe fear. They essentially are triggered by traumatic events or a stress response. So it's actually an adaptive response so that the person can process the trauma that they were just exposed to when they're emotionally ready to do so. So it's almost a shutdown. I think that Maura was exhibiting those behaviors that night.
They call it, you know, like the fight, flight, or freeze response.
Yes, yep.
When your HPA axis, which I think is the hypothalamic pituitary.
I do know. Yep.
Yeah. Yep, it is, yeah. Yep. So when that's activated, it's usually in response to something that's really traumatic or stressful. And freeze is one of the responses. And I think that's maybe what was going on with her, that she had just received really bad news, just realized something really, really bad. And she was so preoccupied by that, that she was having trouble functioning. And she was responding to prompts by what you were saying. Like when you were prompting her, she would.
Yeah.
But
just slow response. Yeah, slow responses and not the norm.
And you knew her for, you said you were friends with her for
exactly.
6 months.
Exactly. So we worked plenty together before that.
And you had never.
Never. We had great conversations. Never like that.
Right. And I know when sometimes people are in a bad mood, like just a general bad mood, sometimes they won't respond. Like it's like,
exactly.
Like when you were first saying that when you invited her to get coffee with you in the morning, she didn't even answer. Like I could see someone just in a bad mood, just, but it didn't seem like that either.
It was very worrisome.
How does this differ from an anxiety attack?
Basically the source of it is pretty similar. An anxiety attack can be prompted by the activation of the HPA axis. It can last from minutes to hours. Usually it's characterized by, you know, catatonic-like behavior or like hyperventilation. You see that a lot. People can't breathe. They feel like they can't breathe. They have the physiological symptoms where they feel like they might vomit. They feel like they're having a heart attack. You know, ambulances are frequently called when people are having a panic attack with those symptoms when they don't know what it is. But you also do see people that just sort of freeze.
Lance, as you know, hiring is a challenge. As you know, we're trying to hire a videographer / editor here at Crawl Space Media.
Yeah, we got a lot of things in the pipeline, and we just can't seem to manage everything. I wish there was a way that we could streamline this and get somebody in here who was the right candidate for this job.
Actually, Lance, there is one place we can go. Yeah, where hiring is simple, fast, and smart. A place where growing businesses like Crawl Space Media connect to qualified candidates. Do you know what that place is called?
I'm racking my brain.
It's called ZipRecruiter.
Oh, I should have known.
Yeah, you got to go to ZipRecruiter.com/MMM and you can post your job for free.
And ZipRecruiter sends your job to over 100 of the web's leading job boards, but they don't stop there.
No, they sure don't, Lance. With their powerful matching technology, ZipRecruiter scans thousands of resumes to find the people with the right experience and invites them to apply to our job, hence the emails we got from qualified candidates.
Well, Tim, ZipRecruiter is so effective that 80% of employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate through the site within the first day.
Amazing. And we have gotten several qualified candidates, Lance. So if you're hearing this and you're like, wait a second, I want to work for Crawl Space Media. Where is this ad? Well, we took it down because we got so many qualified candidates.
And with results like that, it's no wonder that ZipRecruiter is the highest rated hiring site in America.
And right now, our listeners can try ZipRecruiter for free at this exclusive web address.
Give it to me.
ZipRecruiter.com/MMM.
Just so I have it right, that's ZipRecruiter.com/MMM.
ZipRecruiter.com/MMM. Yeah, that is right.
Man, ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. So you drop Maura off at the elevator,
yes.
And you're still expressing concern for her.
Yes.
You go back to work. How did the rest of your night play out?
It was nothing out of the ordinary because I don't really have memories of that exact night. So nothing big happened on campus. I remember just on Thursday nights, we would head back to the office at, we would like leave. The receptionist would get off duty. I think it was like 1:30. So we'd be done by 1:45 in the field area. By 2:30, we were done our shifts because weekends would be end at 3:30. And I had to teach the next morning, so I was just glad to get home because I was exhausted, I remember. And but then when I was driving back, it started snowing that night. So I'm like, oh, that's, you know, kind of cool that, you know, might have no school type of thing for teachers. Makes you very happy. So we never ended up going out for coffee that night because I didn't have four-wheel drive at the time with my car. So I didn't feel like going all the way down to Hadley in the snowstorm.
So it was snowing that bad where you considered?
I'm a very nervous driver. I don't like driving in any snow. So I don't know that. It was accumulating on the ground. It was maybe like an inch or two at that point when I was leaving.
Okay.
Yeah.
It's good to, to know because we know that Maura had that first accident with her dad's car. You know, I don't know how often they plow through there. I don't know about icy conditions. You know, people have just been asking us over the course of the show, what were the road conditions like?
Exactly.
And there's, you know, if there was a snowstorm that went from Thursday to Friday, maybe to the weekend, you know, who knows?
Because the next morning when I woke up, I think we had a delay and I started to get to one of my classes. I just remember thinking I felt happy thinking that she could sleep and not worry because she told me she had like something with nursing, like a nursing test. I'm like, oh, that's good. She won't have to, you know, get up and, you know, go to that. So that and I had to get my kid to school anyways. He was in kindergarten at the time. So I had to get him they had a late start or something. So at that point, that was my last interaction with her that night, going into the night early morning for that Friday morning. So.
And so based on your past conversations mm-hmm. with Maura over the previous 6 months, this was completely different, obviously.
Completely different.
And you had really friendly conversations with her in the past. There was no sign of anything like this. Did she ever talk about her family or anything like that?
Nope, never.
Any troubles? Billy boyfriend troubles, anything?
No, she never talked. She never shared with me anything personal over that time period. We mainly talked about the White Mountains hiking because we loved to go hiking. We'd talk about different trails we'd go hiking on. And at that point, I was in the process of adopting when I met my husband, back then boyfriend, then fiance, I adopted his child in college. So I was talking about that adoption route of raising him and all that stuff. So nothing but I really didn't know if she had any other friends on campus. Like, I didn't know her personal life. Like, I never knew she ran track stuff. I didn't know. So,
did she share stressors with her nursing program? Because I just imagine that she was under a lot of pressure constantly.
She always had, I probably joked with her because I remember she always had that huge, like, nursing book on her desk. So, I probably joke with her, so she probably didn't express stress. Like, I maybe should have been more serious talking about her nursing program. Because now I realize it was a tough, tough program. I didn't know back then it was that bad.
Yeah.
But I heard it's extremely difficult.
It's very intense.
Extremely.
To this day, you know.
I bet it is. So I'm sure she had a lot of stressors, but she didn't get into anything specifically about the nursing program with me.
Right. When I just think back to, you know, her textbooks open.
Yep.
She has her
yep.
phone out. She just seems like someone in general that was pretty adhering to rules and regulations. Like, I bet before that she was probably a really good employee. That's what everyone says about her, that she was just very dedicated, focused, a great student. I remember I had brief interaction with one of her professors who just she was just like a wonderful student, very smart. So for her to be violating multiple rules right in front of you, right in front of the supervisor, it's completely out of character. And I think it just really speaks to an inability to function, an inability to regulate her emotions so she could just, you know, come back to that moment. She just was not able to.
Exactly.
I'm wondering, what do you think her super... So you said that your supervisor said you should probably check in with Maura, or was it a coworker that said you should check in?
It was a coworker. So we were... our supervisor, so it's like a tiered system. So the head of, because I was kind of like Mara's, but like it's like a chain of command type of thing. So my boss would have been the one, and he would usually travel, he or she would travel around at night. So it was Nate that night, but he was in the office, in the dispatch office, when I called him to ask if she could get off duty that evening. Sometimes they're not. Sometimes they're like traveling around campus. We just meet up with them. So he gave me the okay when he was in the office that night that she could go home.
Right. So I wonder what his interaction was with her, or if someone just told him, like if he encountered her. I wonder what his account of the situation is, if she said anything to him or if she, I don't know.
Because I do wonder that too, because they told me Maura is very upset. So I don't know where exactly. That's a great point.
Yeah. I wonder if anything was said to him or if he saw anything of note.
Of why they figured out she was upset.
Yeah.
Exactly. I don't know.
Now, just curious about something. Psychologically speaking, I'm not really at all educated to talk about this, but I suppose I can ask questions. She lied to you, technically, right? She said, I have a roommate. That wasn't true. So for someone to be in this state who's, you know, seems pretty focused on something internal, as we talked about, and then she actually tells a lie to be more alone, obviously. I think we can all admit that was the reason that she lied. It was so she would be left alone. But doesn't that show that there's some like deeper thought process there?
Yeah, I think like a complete shutdown that we're talking about, like it she wouldn't be able to make up something on the fly. Like, I'm not even sure if she had a nursing test the next day. I'm not even sure if she was upset because of her sister. I think she didn't want it. She didn't want to tell you. She didn't want to talk about it. So it could have just been something she just said. I think she was also on the phone with Billy that night. And I think more likely it was something that he had said or done or a result of their conversation, just based on the reaction.
Yeah, no, I agree with that. Yeah.
And you said before she had never really mentioned Billy to you?
No. So I really did. I felt like a bad friend after all this happened. I never knew anything about Billy or her track friends. So no, I did not.
I suppose it wouldn't be you being a bad friend. Yeah. It's more like you knew her through work.
That was it. Exactly.
Yeah. And I mean, if he's not there at the school, I could see where that just wouldn't come up. I think.
Yeah. It never came up, though. Never. Yeah.
Yeah, your approach, I think, was like you're being very social, you know, like, let's talk about this. Do you want to come get coffee and donuts with me and my friends? And she just wanted to deal with it alone or wasn't able to be social in that moment. So,
and I didn't mention it, too. I forgot when after I gave, I remember now because it always stays in my mind. After I gave her my phone number to say, you know, like, let's go. Because I offered her to go to Dunkin's that after shift that, well, not night, early morning it would have been when we got out of shift on Thursday or the next morning. But and I remember saying to her, you know, there's a health services right in UMass. And I did a little fib to her because I was struggling with anxiety at that time as well myself. But I've never been to that health services, but I knew it was 24 hours. So I said, I've been there before. Like, I did a fib to try to get her to go there. I'm like, I've been there before. They're really wonderful. Can I bring you to health? Can we go to health services as well? And but she wouldn't even respond to that yes or no, I remember. So, like, I threw that out there, even though I'd never been there. But I knew where it was located on campus. And I know I could have walked there with her and, you know, found someone.
So you said you really didn't want to leave her alone. And obviously, like, with her behavior, I think if any of us were there, we would all feel the same way. Yep. I wonder what happened the rest of that evening.
I know.
Well, yeah. So let's kind of break it down a little bit what we know, because this was Thursday evening. This was about 96 hours before she went missing. So there was a lot of time. You know, it's not like she went upstairs and no one ever saw her again.
Exactly.
You know, she had some days there where she experienced time with other people. So I'm confused how she kind of comes out of this state, exists for a few days. She obviously, we know she crashed her dad's car at one point. So that could further intensify these feelings. And then we know there was supposedly some gathering one of these nights with some close friends.
And we know that she wrote that email that essentially said she was leaving due to a death in the family.
She did some research.
She did some research on her computer.
Yeah.
Yep.
And I think she emailed her security supervisor, like my boss, one of the nights. Didn't she email them to say she wouldn't be working that week too, I thought?
So, the question that I don't know if we'll ever know the answer to is whether or not that phone call led her to send those emails and led her to have a bad moment with her dad's car the next night or the Saturday night.
We've all dealt with hardship, you know, like a relationship ending, having a really hard time keeping up with classes, a fear, whether it's based on reality or not, that you're not going to pass a course, that you're going to disappoint people, crashing your dad. I've never done that, but crashing your father's car, these things all happening on their own, she would have been equipped to handle. But when all these things just happen all at the same time, I understand being so overwhelmed that you feel like you just need a break from school. And I think whatever she was upset about that night, coupled with wrecking her dad's car, I just think, and the stress from school, because I can't even imagine what it's like to be in that program. And the fact that she literally brought her textbook everywhere kind of says everything. Like, no matter what she was doing, she was studying.
She was always studying. I remember she always had her, like, some people when they were working wouldn't have, like, they wouldn't be working, they'd just be hanging out with friends, whatever. She always had her books with her, always, like her other shifts.
So between the morning you woke up on Friday and you thought to yourself, oh, that's nice, it's snowing, maybe she doesn't have to take the test, maybe that'll be postponed, you thought about her the next morning, one of the first thoughts that you had.
Yes.
Did you think about her on Saturday and on Sunday? And did you hear about the accident with her dad's car?
Over the weekends, because it was so long ago, but I definitely thought about her because it really affected me. Like, I felt horrible, like, that night, horrible leaving her like that. And I, like, knew something was up. Like, I knew that was, it was not the norm. So I definitely felt like bad that weekend. Like I should have did more. Like I remember thinking like, oh, I should have probably tried to call like her family to make sure that she's like, to like make sure her family, like that she's okay. But then I got so busy with like the rest of the weekend. I'm sure I didn't do that. And I always felt guilty for that. But it was when I forget the exact night I was working because she had the accident Monday night, right?
Yeah.
Monday night. And it was one of the nights that week that I was working again on shift when I got a phone call from my supervisor in the office again wanting me to call them. So I called them and they asked me if I had worked with Mara like the previous, they gave me the date like that Thursday night, the previous Thursday. And I said I had. And then they told me she got in a car accident. And that's all they told me, that she got in a car accident. And at that point, it was a very short conversation because they had nothing else really to share with me. And I just remember getting super upset because I had a bad feeling when I saw her last, and when I heard that she got a car accident in the White Mountains, I automatically thought she like went up to like kill herself because how I saw her last, it was wicked upsetting. And that night when I was working, my supervisor called me back at some point, maybe I forget the exact time, and he just said one of the police officers wanted to talk to you quickly. So I called the police department, which was right below the security office anyways, and he just asked me, I forget who it was, one of them wanted me to go in tomorrow, just the next morning, to write a statement for my last interaction with her. I said, of course, I would love to. So the next morning, I'm not sure if this was the Thursday morning or the Friday morning I did the statement. I don't remember the date. It was that week, though. I just forget when I got word of all what happened. So I kind of, I just remember writing the statement with pretty much everything I've shared with you. I might have had more great detail, like more like with the verbal communication details. I don't know. But, and I just remember writing that. I remember leaving. I remember wanting them to ask me more questions to try to, because I was super upset. And I just remember they didn't even want to like talk about it. I just like gave the statement. I wish I could have. I don't know. I felt like it was a disservice. I wasn't giving more information. Just written. I don't know.
You wanted to help as much.
I wanted to guess. Yeah. Yes.
I think that's pretty common when people are, you know, they feel like they can help and they have the information, and when they are
no one wants it from
you. Yeah, especially when you're in front of the police and you give your statement and you want to say, well, this happened and you want to contribute because you are a human being.
And I remember I felt so worried about her. I wanted them to realize how worried I was about her mental state when I last saw her, because I was very worried about her. So I wanted them to get that biggest piece of it all too.
Hi, listeners. If you're a fan of this show, I have another podcast that you should check out. It's called Up and Vanished. The hit true crime podcast is back for its second season. Produced by Tenderfoot TV in Atlanta, Up and Vanish merges storytelling and investigation, highlighting a new missing persons case each season and bringing you inside the investigation.
Last season, host Payne Lindsay revived a cold case concerning Tara Grinstead, a teacher and former pageant queen from Georgia who went missing over 10 years ago. Through tips, cooperation from the community, and sometimes major pushback, Payne brought new attention to the case. This renewed interest and buzz ultimately led to a confession, two arrests, and a pending trial.
Season 2 investigates the disappearance of a young mother from an obscure remote town in Colorado. Crystal Ann Reisinger moved to Crestone to pursue her spiritual path and has been missing since 2016. Was this a spiritual walkabout gone wrong, or something far worse? Follow along as Payne and his team investigate further, tracing Crystal's journey and asking for answers.
Up and Vanish Season 2 is available now. Listen for free on Apple Podcasts and join the conversation at upandvanished.com.
What other investigators or investigation forces did you talk to?
Not an investigation force, but I think it was like a week or two. Like, I just remember after that, I remember the first few weeks, I would just watch things on the news. It was super upsetting to watch the news stuff about her and not having more, like, not talking to more people about it, because it was really, really horrible. But then I remember Sharon, how do you pronounce her last name? Roush?
Yep, correct.
Billy's mom, correct?
Yep.
I forget how she contacted me. I think she found my school email, but she somehow, or it would have been my personal, I don't know, but she emailed me and she asked me if she could talk to me. And I'm like, of course I'd love to, because I didn't know her. I didn't know about Billy yet or the connection. of who he was, who she was. At first, I thought she was one of Mara's, like her mother. I didn't know. I thought it was just like an aunt or something.
So she introduced herself as Mara's,
She just said her name. So it was my fault. I didn't know who she was at first. And then when I talked to her, she told me she was Billy's mom. And I'm like, oh, okay. So once I talked to her, she I think it was a quick email, like, can you just give me a call? I would like to talk to you about Mara. So I'm like, and I just emailed, of course.
Is that the first time that you learned that Mara had a boyfriend?
Yes. Okay. Yep. It would have been. Yep. Yep. Because she, and I remember because she started, when I called her one of the evenings, she started right away explaining her relationship to Mara, of how Mara would always, he was Ohio, correct? Ohio? Mm-hmm. How she would go to Ohio some summers with them. They would, they had some great summers together. I remember she told me a lot about the personal stuff about Mara and Billy and the two of them. And then I think she asked me, and I just remember sharing the same conversation, like what I share with you. I shared pretty much the same thing I shared with her that night on the phone as well. But she didn't have many questions, too many questions from that at the end. She was very thankful that I talked to her, though.
I was just looking at the phone records because I just wanted to just clarify the times of everything. So this would have been, it was the night of February 5th to the early morning hours of February 6th. Is that right?
Yes.
And you said soon after you were told that Mara wasn't in a good space, you were probably got over there in minutes.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Like within 3 minutes. Yeah.
And how sure are you about the time?
10th. I would have to try to think. 10:30. I think I got over there. So I would have thought I would have been there by 10:35, 10:40. But after all these years, I could have been mistaken about that. Like if it was I'm not 100%.
Right.
Not at this point. I wish it was closer till when it happened. But I originally thought 10:30, 10 to 10:45.
It's I ask because it's commonly cited online that it was more 1 in the morning, 1:15. And if that's true, so her call with Kathleen was at 10:10 p.m. and lasted for 28 minutes. And then at 12:07 a.m., she had a call with Billy for 7 minutes.
Interesting. Okay.
And they say that the crying and kind of stupor episode was at 1:15, but I know it's been 14 years, but that's definitely, it's interesting.
It wouldn't have, it's 1 minute, 1:45.
It's a really good question because, was this moment after the phone call with Kathleen, or was it after potential phone call with Bill about an hour and a half later?
Right. So according to the phone records, if that was the result of the conversation with Bill, that lasted 7 minutes?
Yes, it lasted 7 minutes. So the phone call would have ended at 12:15. So
you would have talked to her at about 12:20.
And it would have been, if that was, yes.
It
would have been
a conversation with Bill.
Exactly.
But you're pretty sure it was earlier.
I'm pretty sure it was earlier, just because I remember she had a lot of her shift left. So I, if it was only an hour left, I probably just would have left her, let her leave, not even tell anyone about it, but she's gone. That's why I'm thinking, but I guess I'm not 100% accurate.
And her shift ended at 1?
It would have ended at 1, it would have been 1 and 1:30, because I was done by 2:30, because we would pack them up. So I think it would have ended at 1:30.
So if this had happened at about 12:15 or 12:20, after all of the interaction that you had with her when you went there and she said, my sister, and you were trying to get her to talk and you packed the stuff up, it would have been about 12:45 anyway by the time you were to get her out of there, I would imagine. Because it wasn't just you walk in, she's upset, and you say, okay, we're leaving.
Exactly. It was a process. It took a while. Yeah.
It kind of sounds like she made the call to Bill when she was alone in her dorm, just based on we're talking about here.
Because there is a phone call at about 10:10. That's on her phone record anyway.
That lasted 28 minutes, and then Karen says she was there around 10:45.
And that would make sense, because I would get to Southwest around 10 o'clock, 10:30 those nights. So that would make sense, because that's true, though, because I would have never been getting to Southwest that late on a Thursday evening.
Right.
Good to talk this out.
Exactly. This all makes sense. Right. She talks to her sister. She says, my sister. She's very upset about something. She goes back and has a conversation with her boyfriend. That makes total sense.
The misinformation out there is so frustrating, because for the longest time I was thinking, why is so much attention on the call with Kathleen if she talked to Billy more recently? But it doesn't seem like that's the case.
And so in the Oxygen show, I don't know if you watched the...
I did watch it.
They actually, they talk about this moment, my sister moment that Mara had with you, and Kathleen, Mora's sister, said that based on their phone call, the only thing that she could have thought that it was that she had been leaving a rehab facility, and her husband at the time stopped at a liquor store on the way home from that rehab. And so that is certainly enough to upset someone, a loved family member, of course. Does that sound like that could have been the case?
I don't know. When I was in an armed robbery years ago, when I had a gun to my head, I remember being in that exact same mental scenario where I couldn't communicate, couldn't do this and this. And I'm not saying that's what happened, but I'm saying it had to be some major stressor that I was thinking that would make her feel like that. I don't know. It just
I agree major, with that.
It's because I had that because when that happened years ago with that with my the robbery, I couldn't speak to people. I couldn't communicate. Like I couldn't even like talk to the people like next. Like I just so I felt like it had to be a conversation that was like I don't know that was really bad. Like something really bad.
Would you say that there was any anger there?
No. Just couldn't communicate. Like I shut down. Like I physically like shut down. Like emotionally like.
That's what it sounds like. The fact that when you saw her, that you felt like you needed to kind of go into crisis mode.
Yes.
Like you weren't sure exactly how to approach her. You weren't sure the right things to say. I mean, people say that it wasn't really like Maura to cry at all. I'm sure that if that is what happened in the conversation with Kathleen, I'm sure she would have been really upset. But honestly, like when I think about people, peers of mine that I've seen have a reaction like that, like outside of a psychiatric setting, you know, it's misleading to say, oh, the only in my job, the people I've seen like that have been whatever. But I'm just trying to think about peers of mine. The only time I've seen anyone that upset is because they were just dumped or because someone died.
Yep.
Like a sad
reaction.
Yeah.
Like
right. And it was a good point that you just brought up, Tim, with Kathleen saying the conversation was this. I would have just expected Maura to have more anger about Tim Carpenter taking her to a liquor store and being a direct factor in her falling off the wagon. Like
instead
enabling.
Of being sad.
Yeah,
instead
of being mad.
I mean, she'd be sad, but I would imagine like maybe, you know, she's like shoving things into her bag.
But Chloe, doesn't that emotion kind of come from the same place? And it?
Yes,
but
it does.
It would just come out in different ways. Might come out in anger in one way. Might come out in...
Right, because,
silence
I mean,
way.
Learning that information comes with a lot of emotions. You know, she's crying because her sister can't seem to stay on the wagon, can't seem to keep it together. She's worried about what might happen to her. And there's anger as well. And I don't know what the dominant emotion is. I feel like it's easier to feel angry than it is to feel sad. And maybe channeling that in that moment would have made it so she was able to regulate. Because that's like the whole issue is that she could not regulate and function. So I feel like it's easier to be angry and be like, oh, like my brother-in-law is such an asshole. He's not being helpful towards my sister. And I've had those feelings. And I feel like my sister's been dating an asshole. And it pisses me off. And it's easier to be pissed off at the boyfriend than to be upset and sad about my sister.
I think it is easier, as you said, to be angry at this. But maybe it's just the case where there were so many emotions that it did kind of just shut her down internally.
Totally overwhelming.
Yeah.
And couldn't something have happened, like, maybe it could, like, with emotions, can it be, like, from that same day, like, if bad stuff happens in the morning, afternoon, like, can it also, like, keep building until, you explode, too?
That's what I think happened, honestly. It's, like, a stress fracture. Like
not just, like, that one, and maybe it's, like, stuff before the phone call, too. I don't know.
Yeah.
But maybe.
I think that if, when you have a number of things that are really, really difficult, like, you kind of just become really overwhelmed and collapse under the pressure, and, you know.
Yeah.
The person that your coworker that told you that Maura wasn't in a good place.
Yes.
Have you spoken to him since about what he might have seen?
I don't remember how long ago, but it might have been like 6 or 7 years ago. I reached out to him on Facebook just to say I was curious if you had any other information. I just wanted to talk to him about what happened way back in the days, if he had any other memories of when we last saw her that night. And he never got back to me on the Facebook Messenger. So I'm not sure if he just was. It's a tough topic if you think of like. So I'm not sure if he just wasn't comfortable. He never got. I don't know. That's a great question.
To commiserate for a moment, I've sent messages on Facebook about Maura to people, and it's often you don't hear a response.
Yeah.
It's just a bizarre thing to get an unsolicited email about, I think. Yeah,
exactly.
Can we go back to when Sharon contacted
you? Of course.
Did she ever say if she had contacted other people, and if so, who else did she speak with?
I don't believe so. I don't believe she shared that with me. She might have, because it was such a long ago conversation. But no, the main thing I got for the conversation, she just was explaining how much she loved her when she would come to her. Were they on a farm? I'm trying to remember. She explained about being on a farm and how Maragopa is some summer. Like, I'm not sure what summer is. And it was more like an emotionally sad conversation with her telling me all these stories than she wanted to hear about. So no, I didn't get any other information for what she was pursuing or doing to help out.
So other than speaking with Sharon Rausch, and you gave a statement to the UMass police, was it?
Yes. Okay. Yes, it was.
And so you never spoke to Mass State Police, New Hampshire State Police?
That's correct. I never have.
FBI, New Hampshire League of Investigators?
Nope.
Okay.
I'm glad they at least got a written statement soon after, because, you know, this is 14 years later, and I'm sure it was a really resonating moment for you, and it's kind of sounds like you remember it as clear as day. But I would hope that the state police, the FBI, whomever has your written statement.
I would hope so.
If that's the case, maybe that's why they haven't followed up, because, you know, her memory is freshest at that point.
Exactly. I don't know. Exactly. Yeah.
Can you explain the t-shirt that you're wearing?
Of course, I would love to. So my t-shirt says, share your sphere, living organ donor. Can I tell you the quick story about it? Because it's a beautiful story. So I'm a teacher. I love teaching. I love kids. I have five of my own. They're crazy. I love them. Very expensive. They are. So I teach second grade, but I teach in Stowe, Massachusetts. And last spring, there was a little boy in our school who got a heart transplant, Ari. And he died, I think it was like 3 or 4 months after he had acute rejection. So right after he passed away, you might have seen him on the news. He was on Good Morning America with a baseball bat at Boston General Hospital. You might have seen him. He was such a sweetie pie. Beautiful, beautiful family. So right after he died on Facebook, it was like a share from a friend of a share. I read about a wife who wrote this really nice but sad post about her husband needing a kidney. He was like doing the best he could working, and it was really sad. I was already an emotional wreck from my little love. So I contacted her, and it's crazy. I was such a perfect match. I didn't even know them. And now we're besties. I call him my twinsie, Michael. He's my twinsie. He is my lefty. And now so
he's got your left kidney.
He got my lefty. Yep. Wow. And he's doing wonderful.
How long ago was that?
April 12th was a surgery date.
You're amazing, Kat.
You got your kidney taken out like 4 months ago.
Yeah. Yes. Isn't that wonderful? I highly recommend it.
You never met him. It was just...
I met him once. It's a long process going... Well, a beautiful process. I don't want to discard, but it took a while, the process, but I met him right before the surgery. So you go, it's all about cross matching and tissue matching. So like you were saying, Chloe, you have an identical twin. So God forbid, but you know, if anything ever happens, you have a beautiful tissue matching, perfect antigen pairs. Perfect antigen
pairs. You know, use her for parts.
Yes, yep. You can. So it's just crazy that we were such a great match. But if we weren't a great match, I would have also been, have you heard of the kidney chains? It's beautiful.
No.
Let's say you have a loved one who needs a kidney, and you're, depending on your blood type, you join a chain through these hospitals. So you give a kidney to some stranger, and then eventually you'll get a kidney for your loved one. So you give one to someone. It's like a long chain.
I've heard of that. If everyone agrees, it's really mutually beneficial. Yes.
But this was amazing. I believe it was like fate that we were a perfect match. It's not a perfect match. We're a really strong match.
Is there a website you can give us to send people to?
Oh, I no, but I want to, because I actually have three really close friends right now I'm trying to get kidneys for, all O's. It doesn't matter if you're positive or negative. Mike, Steve, and Pam, they're all from the area. One's from Hudson, one's from Clinton, and one's from, I just met the other one. They're from North Shore area. So maybe we could figure that out.
Yeah.
Wherever one has to go, if they're interested to do this, where would they go? Like, if they hear this and they say, I'm interested in doing this, where can they go?
You go, if you want to just be an all, because I'm considered an altruistic donor, meaning I did not know the person I gave it to. So a lot of the time, it's a loved one who you want to donate for, you know, of course. You go through their hospitals, wherever they like registered is, because you have to be on the transplant list to get a transplant, like it's a national registry. So if it's someone you know, you go through their hospital to get tested. But if you want to just give a kidney out of the wonderfulness of your heart, it's the National Kidney Registry. You go through them. Okay. You just type in National Kidney Registry. It'll show you.
Okay, great.
Or contact me for some people who need some.